In that case, we won't give you the mark. But as long as you're generally on point, it's okay. Because there can be no absolutely correct answer, because most of these articles that you read is not going to give you the exact things. You have to think a little bit and think which one is more likely. So at the end, you're making like a guess, but it's an educated guess, right? It's one that has some logic behind it. So I cannot say you guess wrong if the answer is not there, as long as it's logically incorrect, right? So there's actually a lot of interesting places to get cybersecurity stories. So sometimes you read it in the newspaper, sometimes you can read it online anywhere. But generally, there are also some other good sources. So I think the one that sort of goes worldwide is something called SANS. So SANS is like information security almost for executives. So what they do is they take everything that happened in a given week in terms of cybersecurity, and they try to condense it down to like easy to read short story, like a short item. And this is, these people had this attack. These people discovered this new problem, right? Here is a new vulnerability that people are talking about. And they basically distill it down, break it down into a small, easily readable paragraph. And then once a week, they send an email out to anyone that subscribes to their newsletter to basically give them these short information pieces about the past week. And then sometimes they reference you to longer, more detailed things. But the idea is that everybody can just keep up to date with interesting things that happen in cybersecurity. Right. And then there's something similar also by the UK government. So they have these updated threat reports, like things that have happened, software that is now insecure, various type of things that people might want to look into. So it doesn't give like detailed information, but it gives you like a little bit of an overview of what is going on. Okay. Right. So that brings us then to question two. So question two combines a lot of things together. Mostly it's a test of mode of operation for Blockcypher. So we want you to see what happens actually when some of these block ciphers work and you have errors and you do the encryption. But we can't really ask you to do DES or AES, so we just give you a simple substitution cipher. And then there's different variations, so we want to encrypt you. We ask you to encrypt the same message twice with CBC mode, but using two different IDs. We ask you to encrypt counter mode, and then finally, for the CBC mode, we ask you what happens if you have a bit error and what happens when you have a lost block. Right. So for the first one, so you have to encrypt the message Bob Alice. So if you map Bob Alice message to binary sequences, given the alphabet there, right? Then you can put it into this binary representation. So there's 8 4-bit binary strings, right? And every single time you're going to take one string, you can, once you have the string, so the only thing that's a little bit tricky is you have to keep track of strings and letters at the same time, because sometimes you have to do the binary string manipulation first and then map it back to a character to do the substitution cipher. Right. And the substitution cipher is just a simple shift cipher with E equals. So for the first encryption, CBC mode with ID 001. So we know that CBC encryption, C0 is the encryption of ID XOR P1, C1 is the encryption of C0 XOR P1. So this means it's the encryption of ID, which is 0011, and P0, which is Alice, right? No, it's Bob Alice. So Bob, the first letter is B. So it's 0001. So first we XOR them together. So a 0 and a 0 is a 0, a 0 and a 0 is a 0, a 1 and a 0 is a 1, and a 1 and a 1 is a 0. Alright? So then this maps back to a C, and if we do the substitution cipher encrypting the C, it encrypts to an N. Alright? And then C1 is C0 XOR to P1, so it's F XOR to O. Right? So we put the F here, we put the O here, we XOR the two together, which gives us an L, and then we encrypt the L, it gives us an O. Right? same and the same and the same until we run out of plain text, and the final cipher text is FOCFDNVI. Okay. So what the second question then asks is, can you do the same thing with a different ID? Right? And it's supposed to illustrate that with CPC mode, the current ciphertext depends not on only on the current plaintext, but also all previous plaintext IDs. Right? So what we should now see is that even though we are encrypting exactly the same message, which is Bob Alice, but we're encrypting it with a new ID, the resultant ciphertext is completely different to what it was before. So before we had this ciphertext, FOCFDMGDI, and now we have ODF, IG, EG, and F. Right? So the ciphertext is very different, even though we are basically encrypting the same value. Right. Then encrypting with counter mode. So the method is the same, it's just the mode is different. So here we are encrypting 0, because it says there the first counter value is 0, right? The initial value is 0. So we're encrypting 0 XOR to P1, up to P0, sorry. So encrypting a 0 is the same as encrypting an A. So we encrypt the A to D, right? And then basically we XOR that to B, which is our first plaintext. Right, and then we XOR 0011 with 0001, and when we XOR them together, we get a C. So the first ciphertext value is a C. And of course, with counter mode, nothing depends on C0. C1 doesn't depend on C0. So we instead encrypt the counter plus 1. Right, which is the same as encrypting B together with plaintext 0. So we're encrypting B to E, then XORing to 0. Right, and we can do everything, and our value is CKGMAOO. Okay, so for DNE, it now becomes a little bit interesting, because it said if the most significant bit of C3 becomes an error, what is the recovered plaintext? So previously, what we had was the most significant bit of C3, basically an F. So an F is a 0101, so basically it becomes a 1101. So it basically becomes an N then, right? So then P3 is C2 XOR the decryption of N, which is equal to I. P4 is C3 XOR the decryption of B, so that's N XOR to O, which is equal to D. So the plaintext is now BODIDICE. So what we can see is the first three letters are still correct. The next two, the P3 and P4, are incorrect. Right? That's what we expect to happen. If we have a bit error, two blocks will be wrong. And then after that, everything is correct again. Right? So the A has turned into an I, the L has turned into a D, but we still have the ICE from Alice's. Okay, so there's two blocks are incorrect, and the rest are fine. And then the final one, if C3 is completely lost, and the receiver does not realize this, so it basically processes C4, C3, C5, C4, C6, and C5, right? So C3 is now lost, so P3 is equal to C2 XOR to the decryption of C4, right? Because this would have been C3, the receiver doesn't know, so he uses C4. Right? So now plaintext 3 becomes an N. Plaintext 4 uses C5 instead of C4. So the plaintext becomes an I. And basically what the plaintext now does is you have BOD, and then you have mice. Right? So what happened here is, obviously we're going to have one less plaintext block, because the receiver received one less plaintext block. Okay, so we can't have the same amount of plaintext blocks because one disappeared. But one block, only one block had an error. So we have Bob is correct. We then have an incorrect block that should have been an L, but it instead is an M. And our A has disappeared altogether. But after that one block and error, basically the last part inherit, right? You're going to have one block in error, but then afterwards, everything will be fine again. Right. Okay, so for the number theory, numbers were quite large, and it's sort of that way on purpose, so you can really struggle with it. So once we give you easier, shorter numbers to do with RSA, algebra, and development, then hopefully that should be straightforward. Okay, so we ask you to use a student ID. So X is your 8-digit student ID, Y is the least significant 4 digits, and basically X is the most. So the Y is the last 4 digits of your student number, and then X is your student number. Right? And the first one is compute 41 to the Y, modulo 18,865. We then want you to calculate phi of Y. So this is a 4-digit number and a 4-digit number. Then we want you to find the greatest common divisor of a student number and this number. And then find integers X and Z. So that X times your student number plus Z times this number is equal to the greatest common divisor of a student number. This one, then we have a modular inverse to calculate. And then finally, there's choose any prime number Z that is smaller than X, calculate X to the X mod Z. Okay. So, I will put the solutions online, so I'm not going to read out everything for you. And I also don't know which student number is which, so I just have to choose one. So I chose the student number a long time ago. This is an example, right? But the basic idea of the square and multiply is that now we have the least significant 4 digits, which is 1840. That is our exponent. So we have to first decide what the values of 2 is, then it's going to give us this exponent. So for me, 1840 is 2 to the 4 plus 2 to the 5 plus 2 to the 8 plus 2 to the 9 plus 2 to the 10. Okay? And then we have to do all the squares to the largest one. So I'm going up all the way to 2 to the 10. So I have 41 squared, which I then calculate as 1681. And then I have 41 to the 4, which is 41 squared all squared. So I can just use my previous answer. Right? And then I keep repeating this, repeating this, repeating this until I get to 41 to the power 2 to the 10. Right? And then basically I collect all the terms that I need again. So I need the 2 to the 4 term. So I need this one here, 6581. I need 2 to the 5. So I need the 14386. I need the 2 to the 8. So I put the 13896. And I need the 2 to the 9. So the 15 41, the one here. And then finally, I need the 2 to the 10, which is 1295. This one here. Right? Then I use my calculator, I can multiply this together, I can do the modular reduction, and I get 5,776. Okay. For the modular inverse, so the important thing to remember is that if we have a composite number, if the last 4 digits of your student number was a prime number, you are very lucky, but it's most likely to be a composite number, we need to factorize it first. So for my chosen student number 1840, I can first see that it's divisible by 4 times, right? And then basically, it's divisible by 5 23 times, and then 23, no, it's divisible by 5 once, and then I'm left with 23. So my 1840 is 2 to the power 4 times 5 times 23. That means 5 1840 is just the phi of this term times the phi of this term times the phi of this term. So it's phi of 2 to the 4, which is 2 to the 4 minus 1 times 2 minus 1, right? 2 to the 3 times 2, so it's 8 times 1. And then for a prime number, it's just phi minus 1, right? Because it's 5 to the power of 0 times 5 minus 1, 23 to the power of 0 times 23 minus 1. Then I multiply it up. I get 705. Okay. And then the greatest common divisor. So to calculate the greatest common divisor, you have to use the Euclidean algorithm. Right. So 1 in this format, right? The something is equal to something times the second number plus a remainder. This will help you do the next question. But if you decide to do the recursive greatest common divisor with the modulus, that is also fine. Okay? And remember then the middle number becomes the number on the left, with your remainder becoming the number in the middle. And then 488,61,840 is equal to 488,61,707 plus 133. And then 488,61,707 is equal to many times 1,303 plus 34, 367,301. Right? And then the greatest common divisor, then the next one is 133 is equal to 3 times 34 plus 31. And we work it down until we basically have 31 is equal to 10 times 3 plus 1. So it just so happens that the greatest common divisor between my student number and this number is 1. Could be that you get something else, and that is perfectly fine, right? If you don't get 1, you can't calculate a modular inverse, but luckily the next question doesn't ask you to do the modular inverse. It just asks you to find the combination of your student number and this number so that it's equal to the greatest common divisor. So even if your greatest common divisor is 5 or 7 or something else, it will still work, right? If it's 1, it is fine as well. So you're going to use the extended Euclidean algorithm, which means you have to work back. So 1 is equal to 31 minus 10 times 3, right? And then we go 1 up, and we see that 3 is equal to 34 minus 31. So we substitute that in for 3 and we multiply it out. And every single time you multiply it out, you actually do the calculation to see if this equation is going to equal to 1, right? And if it's not, you know that you've multiplied out incorrectly, right? And then we substitute for 31, then we substitute for 133, then we substitute for 488,61,707, and then finally what we should have is we should have an equation in this form. Something times your student number plus something else times the given number times this other number, and that is your final answer. Don't have to do anything more, right? It's just asking you to solve. If we were using this to do modular inverse, and we were lucky enough to have a greatest common divisor of 1, then of course we'll take the modular reduction of both sides, and one of these terms will disappear, and you'll end up with the modular inverse for the other. Okay, but it's not asking you to do that yet. It's just asking you to solve for the equation, right? If something times your student number plus something given number is equal to the greatest common divisor. Okay, so E was the modular inverse question, so there's a smaller number. So once again, we do the extended Euclidean algorithm. First, we do the Euclidean algorithm to find the greatest common divisor, which you should find to be 1, right? And then you do the working back, exactly like with the previous question, and then you get to So if it's even, then it's a zero. And if it's odd, it's one. So then you can solve it as one line. Okay? That would be the easier way to do it. Okay. But if you did it the long way, congratulations to you. That's a very good. Okay. And then it's one. Or if you just decided to do square and multiply, also extra congratulations to you. It would be very, very long. Okay. Right. So that's it for number theory. So there's some basic questions about Al-Gamal de Fehama. It's giving you a chance to work through those with very small numbers. So for Al-Gamal, we have a private key, we have a prime, we have a generator, we have a private key x equals 5, compute the public key y, encrypt the message n equals 6 with the random number equals 7, verify the calculation, so just basically decrypt your ciphertext to make sure you get the message out. And then finally, what security service can you provide using Al-Gamal algorithm shown in the class notes. Right? So the public key is just g to the x mod p. So it's 3 to the 5 mod 13, which is equal to 9. In Al-Gamal, we have a two-part ciphertext, a and b. So a is equal to g to the r mod p, so equals 3 to the 7 mod 13 is equal to 3. And b is equal to the message times g to the x to the power r, which is equal to 6 times 9 to the 7 modulo 13, which is equal to 2. And then if we do the decryption, k is equal to a to the x modulo p, which is 3 to the 5 modulo 13, which is equal to 9. And then the message is equal to b times the modulo inverse of k modulo p, which is equal to 2 times the modulo inverse of 9 modulo 13. So we can see that this is just 3, right? 3 times 9 is 27, modulo 13 is 1. So 2 times 3 modulo 3, 13, sorry, which is equal to 6. And then the last part of the question, so given that RSA can do everything, the idea of this question is that you think about what Al-Gamal can and cannot do. So for the Al-Gamal encryption algorithm we showed in the slides, we can only provide confidentiality, we can only encrypt information, right? There are other signature schemes based on Al-Gamal, which I briefly told you about in class in lecture 5, but that is not the one we discussed for the encryption, and not the one you are doing here, right? So this one can only provide us with confidentiality. There's nothing else it can do. You cannot always also sign like RSA does, okay? And then for Diffie-Hellman, consider Diffie-Hellman key exchange of p equals 13 and g equals 7. Alice picks x equal to 5 and Bob picks y equal to 11. What is the shared key? And explain the weakness of Diffie-Hellman and how you can fix it. So a, g to the x mod p, 7 to the 5 modulo 13 is 11. B, g to the y is equal to 7 to 11 modulo 13, which is equal to 2. The k is g to the x to the y, which is equal to 11 to the power 11 modulo 13. You're looking at it from a's perspective. You can also calculate it from b's perspective, and you see it's the same, but the shared key is equal to 6. And then for the weakness, remember we talked about the man in the middle attack. So if Trudy comes in the middle, and she basically makes a key with Alice, and she makes a separate key with Bob, and Alice and Bob doesn't know she's there. So the easiest way to solve that is just to add some data origin authentication between Alice and Bob. And you've now learned about two ways to do that. Either they can sign the data, or they can do a map of the data. So the easiest way to do this is Alice will send g to the a mod e, and the map using the shared key of Alice and Bob, of g to the a mod p and send it to Bob, and Bob will do something similar. So g to the b mod p and the MAC using the shared key a b of g to the b mod p. Okay? And then basically that would ensure that Trudy cannot get involved. So Trudy now comes and then she sends back g to the t to Alice and she sends g to the t to Bob. There's no way for her to generate MAC AB of G to the T mod P. Because she doesn't have the shared key between Alice and Bob, right? So she cannot make this MAC. Alternatively, if you say Alice signs this, it's also okay. Bob signs this, then it's also okay. It should give you exactly the same software, same solution. Okay, and then the final one, you are the owner of online software vendor and your clients purchase and download programs from you over the internet. So you basically want to prevent people from modifying the software. So you want to put a Mac on it and you choose to implement an Ash Mac. And your programmer tells you that he's implementing it in this way. The hash Mac is equal to the hash of EK concatenated to the data. Explain why this is not secure, and then suggest how they should implement it. So in terms of suggesting how they implement it, this is not the same format as we talked about in class, right? Remember, what we talked about in class was that we should hash with one key together with the entire message, and then we should take this hash result and hash it with another key to make our map, right? So this part is only the first part, right? You hash the key together with the map. The problem with doing it like this is that it's simply going to give you an intermediate value, right? So if I calculate the hash of the message, and the message has two message blocks, then I hash K first, followed by hashing M1 and M2, right? So I take my ID, I take my key. For simplicity, we just assume that the key is a block and then we have message block. But it doesn't matter even if it's a message block goes over the message or multiple message blocks. But what happens now is, key gets fed in together with ID, we get a hash output. We hash this result together with the next message block, get the next hash result. And we hash that together with M2 to give us our final hash. And we send that with our software. The biggest problem is then very simple for attackers just to add messages to our message. Right? Somebody could add another block to the message and to create a valid MAC value themselves, even though they don't have the key, they can just then take our hash value and hash it together with the additional message block to give themselves a new valid hash value. And why does this work? Because the key K is already hashed at the beginning there. And no matter how many extra blocks the attacker puts on and simply adds on at the end of the hash by taking our hash value and continuing to hash extra blocks into the hash value will be valid. Right? Because the only time we need the key is right at the beginning, and we have already done that for them. Right? So if we were to implement the hash in this way, it's basically very simple to extend the message to however long we want as an attacker, and to then update the hash to be a new value. Okay. So that is all the solutions. I will put the solutions on Canvas with everything else. Right? And if you have any questions, feel free to ask any of me from the PAs, and we will mark it on Canvas, and we will try and release your marks back to you by next Monday. Right? But you also now have the correct solutions if you want to study for the lecture. I would just add one thing. For most of the questions in the problem sets, apart from question one, question 1 is quite open, so we award marks for different things. For question 2 onwards, if you make a mistake, you will get 0, right? So not for the entire question, but for the particular little question or sub-question that you did. The reason for that is for the problem set, you have open book and an infinite amount of time. So it's very easy for you to check your answer many, many times. So from our perspective, the only challenge there is to be careful and do it correctly, right? I cannot give you a method mark because you can look in your notes what the method was, and then you have like a very long time to apply correctly. So the only challenge is doing it correctly, right? So for the problem sets, we're not going to do method marking. So it's either correct or incorrect. For the quiz or for the exam, if you do a calculation problem and you make a little mistake, we will give you marks. Then we will do method mark. Then we will say, okay, I see the guy had the right idea, but he made it cases, you might not have open book, or you might have very limited time. So there's additional challenge to that, right? But for the problem set, you have all your notes, and you have a very long free time period. So the only thing that's really challenging is doing it correct. But don't worry, for the quiz and the exam, we will give you method mark. We won't mark in the exact same way. Okay. So that is the solution.
Done all the
authentication. Okay? So in authentication, somebody wants to prove their identity to someone else. So Alice wants to prove her identity to Bob. It might also be better to say that Bob actually wants to verify Alice's identity. Right? At the same time, Bob might also want to show Alice that he is indeed Bob. Right? In which case, we do mutual identification. We do both of them at the same time. So, while confidentiality and encryption is very well known, so if you ask anyone who doesn't study technical things or know anything about security, and you ask them, oh, what do you think security is? They'll immediately tell you encryption, right? Because encryption is so easy to understand. I want to hide my data, I want to encrypt it. Right? And encryption is very big, but what people don't realize is that people also use authentication all the time, right? And then when you point it out to them, they're suddenly like, oh yes, that's correct. Whenever I go online, I enter my username and password. There's lots of things I use every single day. I go to the cash machine, or I used to go to the cash machine. I withdraw money. I have a credit card. I want to pay with that credit card. I want to pay with my phone. If I scan my phone, if I scan a QR code, the first thing that happens is the receiver will verify whether that thing is authentic, whether the phone is authentic, whether the user is there, right? If I go on any type of MTR or underground or railway with a smart card-based ticket, like I have an Hong Kong, I have the Hong Kong, the Octopus card, every single time I use that to pay anywhere, it does nothing before we do authentication first, because it has to basically determine whether I have a legitimate card that is based in. Right? So authentication is happening all the time, even though we don't always think that it's happening. Right? So, in terms of authentication, there are different things. Today's lecture is more focusing mainly on authentication of things, not necessarily people. We'll talk about authentication of people later, but something you have, something you are, something you don't. Right? Today's authentication is possibly more in terms of machine-to-machine communication based on crypto and different keys. Okay. So when we do authentication on, let's say, a standalone system that is not connected to anything and it's completely physically secure, then that could be relatively simple. Right? That said, most of the time this is not really. Right? We need to do authentication over a public network. In other words, when we're doing this authentication, attackers can eavesdrop on what we are doing. They can even replay some messages. They can modify some messages. Right? So basically, we need to have a protocol that can be secure even though those attackers are around us all the time. So, for example, if I want to enter into a building, okay, I have my ID card next to the door, there's a little reader. I'm going to put my ID card there. Maybe it's going to ask me some additional verification, like entering a PIN or presenting my face, and then it's going to let me into the building. Right? So if we want to have an analogy of an example of the difference between physical and network systems, we can think of a network system almost as a building that's just there. I scan, I enter the PIN. If I don't get it, I can mess around for as long as I want. If I'm an attacker, I can mess around with everything as long as I want. I can try 1,000 times. I can put a little thing there that predicts other people's transactions, anything. It's not protected. Right? On the other hand, if I want to go into a very sensitive building, in the front of the building, there might be the turnstile that I go into, and the turnstile will be watched over by a security guard, right? So if I come there with my ID and I put it down and the machine beeps and rejects me, or I start fiddling around or touching the thing, the guard is immediately going to come up to me and say, what are you doing here? This is not allowed. And then if my thing looks a little bit wrong, he's probably going to chase me away and call the police or something, right? So that perspective, because there's additional physical security in the system, right? I don't have as much freedom as if I had a chance to mess around with everything. So that's the same as whether we have a network system versus we have a physically secure system. The same happens if we have a cash machine, like an ATM. Okay? I will put my card into it, I will put my PIN into it, right? And this machine basically protects this transaction. It's very difficult for somebody to observe what happens between my card and the machine. Similarly, if I start doing strange things or I enter the PIN incorrectly too many times, the machine will basically eat the card and not give it back. Right? And then I will have to go to the bank for additional verification before I can get it back. That's why people who want to steal people's credit card information, they always try to put hardware into the machine. It's called a SHIP or a SCIP. It's like they will insert it into the real card slot. It's really thin. At the front of it, they'll make it appear like it's part of the machine. So when you put your credit card in, it's not actually in the machine. It's sort of still stuck in this device. And then the device relays the information between the machine and your card. And in that way, it also records everything that goes between the card and the machine. Right? And additionally, they'll hide some sort of camera somewhere that watches your PIN. Right? Which is why most cash machines now have these fancy things where you cannot see what is entering into your PIN. Right? So all of this comes from a specific reason. The same reason you now have special cash machines designed in a way that sort of have plastic things coming out, where you cannot easily insert any additional hardware into the machine itself. Right. Okay. That's an ATM example. So, how do we do authentication over an open network? So let's say we have Alice, and Alice wants to access and read her email. So Alice has a username and password. Alice sends the username and password to the email server in plain text. Okay? This is, of course, a bad idea, because anyone that eavesdrops this message can now forever after pretend to be Alice. Because now I have Alice's username and Alice's password, and I can pretend to be Alice. So pretending to be Alice is called a masquerade attack. I can simply pretend to be someone else. Right. Then we can say, okay, we don't want that to happen. We know that that is bad. We want to fix it. So we don't want Alice to send her username and password in plain text. So what we'll do is we'll tell Alice to encrypt her username and password, let's say using public key encryption. So the email server will send the public key and the certificate of the email server, so we can verify the email server is legitimate. It will come to Alice. Alice will use the email server's public key to encrypt the username and password. Her alternative, Alice can send her username together with the hash of the password to the email server. The email server also stores Alice's password to see if it's valid. The email server will hash the password it keeps and basically compare it to the hash of the password that Alice sent. So now when we have the eavesdropping attacker we had before, they can't actually learn anything. They don't know what Alice's password is. They don't know even here what Alice's username is. So they cannot just take Alice's username and password and log into the email server as though. So in that way, we're basically taking away the basic masquerade attack. However, is this system secure? And if not, you please tell me why. Does this system work? How can I log in as Alice in this system? In this system, I don't need Alice's username and password. I just need this message. Because this message, even though I do not know what her username and password is, contains her username and password. So if I record this message, or I record this message, and I send it to the email server tomorrow, it is also going to log me in as Alice. Right? And this is called a replay attack. Right? I record something Alice made today, I replay it to the server tomorrow, and because it has a password, even though I don't know what those are, the server is going to log me in. Okay, so now we're given the confidentiality, but it didn't entirely work. So what works? So the final way we can design it to make it better against replay attack is that we can say, okay, every single transaction needs some kind of unique aspect, something that links it to having happened just now. So I cannot record it and use it again tomorrow or later today, right? And how would this work? The email server would make a random number. So this random number could be called a nonce. It basically means number only used once, right? And send that to Alice, right? Alice will then do something to her password, encrypt it, hash it, whatever. But when doing so, she will also include this nonce and send it back to the email server. Okay, so this could be encryption, this could be hashing, this could be signing, all sorts of things. Okay? So the email server knows the value of this password, so it can validate this value that goes back. However, I cannot replay the message anymore, because if I record this message, and together tomorrow I go to the email server and I say, hey, I want to log in, the email server is going to give me a different end. Because every single time anyone asks to log in, we get a different end. Okay. And the correct answer would then have to contain the new end, which I don't have. I just have a correct answer for the old end. So therefore, I cannot log in as Alice. So in short, to prevent the replay and the masquerade, the password and username detail is hidden, and we have something that's new every time, or something that's fresh every time, also hidden.